on yourself. If you sit there leaning against this wall all day, you are going to end up leaning on something or someone all your life. And all that brilliance bottled up inside you will go to waste. At that, Gary agreed to go to the board, but then refused to address the work there. After a while, Colin said, "If you do not want to participate, go to the telephone and tell your mother, 'Mother, in this school we have to learn, and Mrs. Collins says I can't fool around, so will you please pick me up?'" Gary started writing. Eventually, Gary became an eager participant and an avid writer. Later that year, the class was discussing Macbeth and how his misguided thinking led him to commit murder. "It's sort of like Socrates says, isn't it, Miss Collins?" Gary piked up. "Macbeth should have known that straight thinking leads to straight living." For a class assignment, he wrote, "Somnus, God of sleep, please awaken us. While we sleep, ignorance takes over the world. Take your spell off us. We don't have long before ignorance makes a coup d'etat of the world." When teachers are judging them, students will sabotage the teacher by not trying. But when students understand that school is for them, a way for them to grow their minds, they do not insist on sabotaging themselves. In my work, I have seen tough guys shed tears when they realize they can become smarter. It's common for students to turn off to school and adopt an air of indifference, but we make a mistake if we think any student stops caring. Growth-minded teachers. Who are these people? How can growth-minded teachers be so selfless, devoting untold hours to the worst students? Are they just saints? Is it reasonable to expect that everyone can become a saint? The answer is that they're not entirely selfless. They love to learn, and teaching is a wonderful way to learn about people and how they tick, about what you teach, about yourself, and about life. Fixed-minded teachers often think of themselves as finished products. Their role is simply to impart their knowledge. But doesn't that get boring year after year? Standing before yet another crowd of faces and imparting? Now that's hard. Seymour Saracen was a professor of mine when I was in graduate school. He was a wonderful educator, and he always told us to question assumptions. "There's an assumption," he said, "that schools are for students learning. Well, why aren't they just as much for teachers learning?" I never forgot that. In all of my teaching, I think about what I find fascinating and what I would love to learn more about. I use my teaching to grow, and that makes me, even after all these years, a fresh and eager teacher. One of Marva Collins's first mentors taught her the same thing, that above all, a good teacher is one who continues to learn along with the students. And she lets her students know that right up front. "Sometimes I don't like other grown-ups very much because they think they know everything. I don't know everything. I can learn all the time." It's been said that Dorothy DeLay was an extraordinary teacher because she was not interested in teaching. She was interested in learning. So are great teachers born or made? Can anyone be a Collins, Esquith, or DeLay? It starts with the growth mindset about yourself and about children. Not just lip service to the idea that all children can learn, but a deep desire to reach in and ignite the mind of every child. Michael Lewis in the New York Times tells of a coach who did this for him. "I had a new taste for extra work, and it didn't take long to figure out how much better my life could be if I applied this new zeal, acquired on a baseball field, to the rest of it. It was as if this baseball coach had reached inside me, found a rusty switch marked turn on before attempting to use, and flipped it." Coaches are teachers too, but their students' successes and failures are played out in front of crowds, published in the newspapers, and written into the record books. Their jobs rest on producing winners. Let's look closely at three legendary coaches to see their mindsets in action. Coaches, winning through mindset. Everyone who knows me well laughs when I say someone is complicated. "What do you think of so-and-so? Oh, he's complicated." It's usually not a compliment. It means that so-and-so may be capable of great charm, warmth, and generosity, but there's an undercurrent of ego that can erupt at any time. You never really know when you can trust him. The fixed mindset makes people complicated. It makes them worried about their fixed traits and creates the need to document them, sometimes at your expense. And it makes them judgmental. The Fixed Mindset Coach in Action. Bobby Knight, the famous and controversial college basketball coach, is complicated. He could be unbelievably kind. One time he passed up an important and lucrative opportunity to be a sportscaster because a former player of his had been in a bad accident. Knight rushed to his side and saw him through the ordeal. He could be extremely gracious. After the basketball team he coached won the Olympic gold medal, he insisted that the team pay homage first and foremost to coach Henry Iba. Iba had never been given proper respect for his Olympic accomplishments, and in whatever way he could, Knight wanted to make up for it. He had the team carry coach Iba around the floor on their shoulders. Knight cared greatly about his players' academic records. He wanted them to get an education, and he had a firm rule against missing classes or tutoring sessions. But he could also be cruel, and this cruelty came from the fixed mindset. John Feinstein, author of Season on the Brink, a book about Knight and his team, tells us, Knight was incapable of accepting failure. Every defeat was personal. His team lost, a team he had selected and coached. Failure on any level all but destroyed him, especially failure in coaching, because it was coaching that gave him his identity, made him special, set him apart. A loss made him a failure, obliterated his identity. So when he was your coach, when your wins and losses measured him, he was mercilessly judgmental. His demeaning of players who let him down was, hopefully, without parallel. In Daryl Thomas, Feinstein says, Knight saw a player of huge potential. Thomas had what coaches call a million-dollar body. He was big and strong, but also fast. He could shoot the ball with his left hand or his right hand. Knight couldn't live with the thought that Thomas and his million-dollar body weren't bringing the team success. You know what you are, Daryl? You are the worst F-pussy I've ever seen play basketball at this school. The absolute worst pussy ever. You have more goddamn ability than 95% of the players we've had here, but you are a pussy from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet. An absolute effing pussy. That's my assessment of you after 3 years. To make a similar point, Knight once put a Tampax into a player's locker. Thomas was a sensitive guy. An assistant coach had given this advice. When he's calling you an asshole, don't listen. But when he starts telling you why you're an asshole, listen. That way you'll get better. Thomas couldn't follow that advice. He heard everything. And after the tirade, he broke down right there on the basketball court. The axe of judgment came down on players who had the audacity to lose a game. Often Knight did not let the guilty parties ride back home with the rest of the team. They were no longer worthy of respectful treatment. One time, after his team reached the semifinals of a national tournament, but not the national tournament, he was asked by an interviewer what he liked best about the team. "What I like best about this team right now," Knight answered, "is the fact that I only have to watch it play one more time." Some players could take it better than others. Steve Alford, who went on to have a professional career, had come to Indiana with clear goals in mind and was able to maintain a strong growth focus much of the time. He was able to hear and use Knight's wisdom and, for the most part, ignore the obscene or demeaning parts of the tirades. But even he describes how the team broke down under the yoke of Knight's judgments, and how he himself became so personally unhappy at some points that he lost his zest for the sport. "The atmosphere was poisonous. When I had been playing well, I had always stayed upbeat, no matter how much coach yelled. But now his negativism, piled on top of my own, was drowning me. Mom and Dad were concerned. They could see the love of the game was going out of me." The Holy Grail. No mistakes. Says Alford, coach's Holy Grail was the mistake-free game. Uh-oh. We know which mindset makes mistakes intolerable. And Knight's explosions were legendary. There was the time he threw the chair across the court. There was the time he yanked his player off the court by his jersey. There was the time he grabbed his player by the neck. He often tried to justify his behavior by saying he was toughening the team up, preparing them to play under pressure. But the truth is, he couldn't control himself. Was the chair a teaching exercise? Was the chokehold educational? He motivated his players, not through respect for them, but through intimidation, through fear. They feared his judgments and explosions. Did it work? Sometimes it worked. He had 3 championship teams. In the season on the brink, described by John Feinstein, the team did not have size, experience, or quickness. But they were contenders. They won 21 games, thanks to Knight's great basketball knowledge and coaching skills. But other times, it didn't work. Individual players or the team as a whole broke down. In the season on the brink, they collapsed at the end of the season. The year before, too, the team had collapsed under Knight's pressure. Over the years, some players had escaped by transferring to other schools, by breaking rules, like cutting classes or skipping tutoring sessions, or by going early to the pros, like Isaiah Thomas. On a world tour, the players often sat around fantasizing about where they should have gone to school if they hadn't made the mistake of choosing Indiana. It's not that Knight had a fixed mindset about his players' ability. He firmly believed in their capacity to develop. But he had a fixed mindset about himself and his coaching ability. The team was his product, and they had to prove his ability every time out. They were not allowed to lose games, make mistakes, or question him in any way, because that would reflect on his competence. Nor did he seem to analyze his motivational strategies when they weren't working. Maybe Daryl Thomas needed another kind of incentive aside from ridicule or humiliation. What are we to make of this complicated man as a mentor to young players? His biggest star, Isaiah Thomas, expresses his profound ambivalence about Knight. "You know, there were times when if I had a gun, I think I would have shot him. And there were other times when I wanted to put my arms around him, hug him, and tell him I loved him. I would not consider myself an unqualified success if my best student had considered shooting me." The Growth Mindset Coach in Action. A Coach for All Seasons. Coach John Wooden produced one of the greatest championships records in sports. He led the UCLA basketball team to the NCAA championship in 1964, 1965, 1967, 1968, 1969, 1970, 1971, 1972, 1973, and 1975. There were seasons when his team was undefeated, and they once had an 88-game winning streak. All of this I sort of knew. What I didn't know was that when Wooden arrived at UCLA, it was a far cry from a basketball dynasty. In fact, he didn't want to work at UCLA at all. He wanted to go to Minnesota. It was arranged that Minnesota would phone him at 6 o'clock on a certain evening to tell him if he had the job. He told UCLA to call him at 7. No one called at 6, 6:30, or even 6:45. So when UCLA called at 7, he said yes. No sooner had he hung up than the call from Minnesota came. A storm had messed up the phone lines and prevented the 6 o'clock phone call with the job offer from getting through. UCLA had grossly inadequate facilities. For his first 16 years, Wooden held practice in a crowded, dark, and poorly ventilated gym, known as the B.O. Barn because of the atmospheric effect of the sweating bodies. In the same gym, there were often wrestling matches, gymnastics training, trampoline jumping, and cheerleading workouts going on alongside basketball practice. There was also no place for the games. For the first few years, they had to use the B.O. Barn, and then for 14 more years, they had to travel around the region borrowing gyms from schools and towns. Then there were the players. When he put them through their first practice, he was shattered. They were so bad that if he'd had an honorable way to back out of the job, he would have. The press had, perceptively, picked his team to finish last in their division. But Wooden went to work, and this laughable team did not finish last. It won the division title, with 22 wins and 7 losses for the season. The next year, they went to the NCAA playoffs. What did he give them? He gave them constant training in the basic skills. He gave them conditioning, and he gave them mindset. The Holy Grail, full preparation and full effort. Wooden is not complicated. He's wise and interesting, but not complicated. He's just a straight-ahead growth mindset guy who lives by this rule. You have to apply yourself each day to become a little better. By applying yourself to the task of becoming a little better each and every day over a period of time, you will become a lot better. He didn't ask for mistake-free games. He didn't demand that his players never lose. He asked for full preparation and full effort from them. Did I win? Did I lose? Those are the wrong questions. The correct question is, did I make my best effort? If so, he says, you may be outscored, but you will never lose. He was not a softy. He did not tolerate coasting. If the players were coasting during practice, he turned out the lights and left. Gentlemen, practice is over. They had lost their opportunity to become better that day. Equal treatment. Like Delay, Wooden gave equal time and attention to all of his players, regardless of their initial skills. They, in turn, gave all and blossomed. Here is Wooden talking about two new players when they arrived at UCLA. I looked at each one to see what he had and then said to myself, oh gracious, if he can make a real contribution, a playing contribution, to our team, then we must be pretty lousy. However, what I couldn't see was what these men had inside. Both gave just about everything they could possibly give and both became starters, one as the starting center on a national championship team. He respected all players equally. You know how some players' numbers are retired after they move on, in homage to their greatness? No player's number was retired while Wooden was coach, although he had some of the greatest players of all time, like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Bill Walton. Later on, when their numbers were retired, he was against it. Other fellows who played on our team also wore those numbers. Some of those players gave me close to everything they had. The jersey and the number on it never belonged to just one single player, no matter how great or how big a star that particular player is. It goes against the whole concept of what a team is. Wait a minute. He was in the business of winning games. Don't you have to go with your talented players and give less to the second stringers? Well, he didn't play all players equally, but he gave to all players equally. For example, when he recruited another player the same year as Bill Walton, he told him that he would play very little in actual games because of Walton. But he promised him, by the time you graduate, you'll get a pro contract. You'll be that good. By his third year, the player was giving Bill Walton all he could handle in practice, and when he turned pro, he was named Rookie of the Year in his league. Preparing players for life. Was Wooden a genius, a magician able to turn mediocre players into champions? Actually, he admits that in terms of basketball tactics and strategies, he was quite average. What he was really good at was analyzing and motivating his players. With these skills, he was able to help his players fulfill their potential, not just in basketball, but in life, something he found even more rewarding than winning games. Did Wooden's methods work? Aside from the 10 championship titles, we have the testimony of his players, none of whom refer to firearms. Bill Walton, Hall of Famer. Of course, the real competition he was preparing us for was life. He taught us the values and characteristics that could make us not only good players, but also good people. Denny Crum, successful coach. I can't imagine what my life would have been had Coach Wooden not been my guiding light. As the years pass, I appreciate him more and more and can only pray that I can have half as much influence on the young people I coach as he has had on me. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Hall of Famer. The wisdom of Coach Wooden had a profound influence on me as an athlete, but an even greater influence on me as a human being. He is responsible, in part, for the person I am today. Listen to this story. It was the moment of victory. UCLA had just won its first national championship. But Coach Wooden was worried about Fred Slaughter, a player who had started every game and had had a brilliant year up until this final championship game. The game had not been going well, and as it got worse and worse, Wooden felt a change had to be made. So he pulled Fred. The replacement player did a great job, and Wooden left him in until the game was virtually won. The victory was a peak moment. Not only had they just won their first NCAA title by beating Duke, but they had ended the season with 30 wins and 0 losses. Yet Wooden's concern for Fred dampened his euphoria. As Wooden left the press conference and went to find Fred, he opened the door to the dressing room. Fred was waiting for him. "Coach, I want you to know I understand. You had to leave Doug in there because he played so well, and I didn't. I wanted to play in the worst way, but I do understand. And if anyone says I was upset, it's not true. Disappointed, yes, but upset, no. And I was very happy for Doug." "There are coaches out there," Wooden says, "who have won championships with the dictator approach, among them Vince Lombardi and Bobby Knight. I had a different philosophy. For me, concern, compassion, and consideration were always priorities of the highest order." Read the story of Fred Slaughter again, and you tell me whether, under the same circumstances, Coach Knight would have rushed to console Daryl Thomas. And would Knight have allowed Thomas to reach down to find his pride, dignity, and generosity in his moment of disappointment? Which is the enemy, success or failure? Pat Summitt is the coach of the Tennessee women's basketball team, the Lady Vols. She has coached them to 6 national championships. She didn't come into the game with Wooden's philosophical attitude, but was at first more Knight-like in her stance. Every time the team lost, she couldn't let go of it. She continued to live it, beating it to death and torturing herself and the team with it. Then she graduated to a love-hate relationship with losing. Emotionally, it still makes her feel sick. But she loves what she does. It forces everyone, players and coaches, to develop a more complete game. It is success that has become the enemy. Wooden calls it being infected with success. Pat Riley, former coach of the championship Los Angeles Lakers team, calls it the disease of me, thinking you are the success and chucking the discipline and the work that got you there. Summitt explains, success lulls you. It makes the most ambitious of us complacent and sloppy. As Summitt spoke, Tennessee had won 5 NCAA championships, but only once when they were favored to win. On every other occasion, we were upset. We lost as many as 4 or 5 titles that we were predicted to win. After the 1996 championship, the team was complacent. The older players were the national champions, and the new players expected to be swept to victory merely by being at Tennessee. It was a disaster. They began to lose and lose badly. On December 15th, they were crushed by Stanford on their own home court. A few games later, they were crushed again. Now they had 5 losses and everyone had given up on them. The North Carolina coach, meaning to comfort Summitt, told her, "Well, just hang in there till next year." HBO had come to Tennessee to film a documentary, but now the producers were looking for another team. Even her assistants were thinking they wouldn't make it into the March championship playoffs. So before the next game, Summitt met with the team for 5 hours. That night, they played Old Dominion, the second-ranked team in the country. For the first time that season, they gave all, but they lost again. It was devastating. They had invested, gone for it, and still lost. Some were sobbing so hard they couldn't speak or even breathe. "Get your heads up," Summitt told them. "If you give effort like this all the time, if you fight like this, I'm telling you, I promise you, we'll be there in March." 2 months later, they were the national champions. Conclusion? Beware of success. It can knock you into a fixed mindset. I won because I have talent, therefore I will keep winning. Success can infect a team or it can infect an individual. Alex Rodriguez, one of the best players in baseball, is not infected with success. "You never stay the same," he says. "You either go one way or the other." Our legacy. As parents, teachers, and coaches, we are entrusted with people's lives. They are our responsibility and our legacy. We know now that the growth mindset has a key role to play in helping us fulfill our mission and in helping them fulfill their potential. Grow your mindset. Every word and action from parent to child sends a message. Tomorrow, listen to what you say to your kids and tune in to the messages you're sending. Are they messages that say, "You have permanent traits and I'm judging them?" Or are they messages that say, "You're a developing person and I'm interested in your development"? How do you use praise? Remember that praising children's intelligence or talent, tempting as it is, sends a fixed mindset message. It makes their confidence and motivation more fragile. Instead, try to focus on the processes they used, their strategies, effort, or choices. Practice working the process praise into your interactions with your children. Watch and listen to yourself carefully when your child messes up. Remember that constructive criticism is feedback that helps the child understand how to fix something. It's not feedback that labels or simply excuses the child. At the end of each day, write down the constructive criticism and the process praise you've given your kids. Parents often set goals their children can work toward. Remember that having an innate talent is not a goal. Expanding skills and knowledge is. Pay careful attention to the goals you set for your children. If you're a teacher, remember that lowering standards doesn't raise students' self-esteem, but neither does raising standards without giving students ways of reaching them. The growth mindset gives you a way to set high standards and have students reach them. Try presenting topics in a growth framework and giving students process feedback. I think you'll like what happens. Do you think of your slower students as kids who will never be able to learn well? Do they think of themselves as permanently dumb? Instead, try to figure out what they don't understand and what learning strategies they don't have. Remember that great teachers believe in the growth of talent and intellect and are fascinated by the process of learning. Are you a fixed mindset coach? Do you think first and foremost about your record and your reputation? Are you intolerant of mistakes? Do you try to motivate your players through judgment? That may be what's holding up your athletes. Try on the growth mindset. Instead of asking for mistake-free games, ask for full commitment and full effort. Instead of judging the players, give them the respect and the coaching they need to develop. As parents, teachers, and coaches, our mission is developing people's potential. Let's use all the lessons of the growth mindset and whatever else we can to do this. Chapter 8, Changing Mindsets, a Workshop. The growth mindset is based on the belief in change, and the most gratifying part of my work is watching people change. Nothing is better than seeing people find their way to the things they value. This chapter is about kids and adults who found their way to using their abilities, and about how all of us can do that. The Nature of Change. I was in the middle of first grade when my family moved. Suddenly, I was in a new school. Everything was unfamiliar, the teacher, the students, and the work. The work was what terrified me. The new class was way ahead of my old one, or at least they seemed that way to me. They were writing letters I hadn't learned to write yet, and there was a way to do everything that everyone seemed to know except me. So when the teacher said, "Class, put your name on your paper in the right place," I had no idea what she meant. So I cried. Each day things came up that I didn't know how to do. Each time I felt lost and overwhelmed. Why didn't I just say to the teacher, "Mrs. Khan, I haven't learned this yet. Could you show me how?" Another time, when I was little, my parents gave me money to go to the movies with an adult and a group of kids. As I rounded the corner to the meeting place, I looked down the block and saw them all leaving. But instead of running after them and yelling, "Wait for me!" I stood frozen, clutching the coins in my hand and watching them recede into the distance. Why didn't I try to stop them or catch up with them? Why did I accept defeat before I had tried some simple tactics? I know that in my dreams I had often performed magical or superhuman feats in the face of danger. I even have a picture of myself in my self-made Superman cape. Why in real life couldn't I do an ordinary thing like ask for help or call out for people to wait? In my work, I see lots of young children like this, bright, seemingly resourceful children who are paralyzed by setbacks. In some of our studies, they just have to take the simplest action to make things better, but they don't. These are the young children with the fixed mindset. When things go wrong, they feel powerless and incapable. Even now, when something goes wrong or when something promising seems to be slipping away, I still have a passing feeling of powerlessness. Does that mean I haven't changed? No, it means that change isn't like surgery. Even when you change, the old beliefs aren't just removed like a worn-out hip or knee and replaced with better ones. Instead, the new beliefs take their place alongside the old ones, and as they become stronger, they give you a different way to think, feel, and act. Beliefs are the key to happiness and to misery. In the 1960s, psychiatrist Aaron Beck was working with his clients when he suddenly realized it was their beliefs that were causing their problems. Just before they felt a wave of anxiety or depression, something quickly flashed through their minds. It could be, "Dr. Beck, I think I'm incompetent," or, "This therapy will never work, I'll never feel better." These kinds of beliefs caused their negative feelings not only in the therapy session, but in their lives, too. They weren't beliefs people were usually conscious of. Yet Beck found he could teach people to pay attention and hear them, and then he discovered he could teach them how to work with and change these beliefs. This is how cognitive therapy was born, one of the most effective therapies ever developed. Whether they're aware of it or not, all people keep a running account of what's happening to them, what it means, and what they should do. In other words, our minds are constantly monitoring and interpreting. That's just how we stay on track. But sometimes the interpretation process goes awry. Some people put more extreme interpretations on things that happen, and they react with exaggerated feelings of anxiety, depression, or anger, or superiority. Mindsets go further. Mindsets frame the running account that's taking place in people's heads. They guide the whole interpretation process. The fixed mindset creates an internal monologue that is focused on judging. This means I'm a loser. This means I'm a better person than they are. This means I'm a bad husband. This means my partner is selfish. In several studies, we probed the way people with a fixed mindset dealt with information they were receiving. We found that they put a very strong evaluation on each and every piece of information. Something good led to a very strong positive label, and something bad led to a very strong negative label. People with a growth mindset are also constantly monitoring what's going on, but their internal monologue is not about judging themselves and others in this way. Certainly they're sensitive to positive and negative information, but they're attuned to its implications for learning and constructive action. What can I learn from this? How can I improve? How can I help my partner to do this better? Now, cognitive therapy basically teaches people to rein in their extreme judgments and make them more reasonable. For example, suppose Alana does poorly on a test and draws the conclusion, "I'm stupid." Cognitive therapy would teach her to look more closely at the facts by asking, "What is the evidence for and against your conclusion?" Alana may, after prodding, come up with a long list of ways in which she has been competent in the past, and may then confess, "I guess I'm not as incompetent as I thought." She may also be encouraged to think of reasons she did poorly on the test other than stupidity, and these may further temper her negative judgment. Alana is then taught how to do this for herself, so that when she judges herself negatively in the future, she can refute the judgment and feel better. In this way, cognitive therapy helps people make more realistic and optimistic judgments, but it does not take them out of the fixed mindset and its world of judgment. It does not confront the basic assumption, the idea that traits are fixed, that is causing them to constantly measure themselves. In other words, it does not escort them out of the framework of judgment and into the framework of growth. This chapter is about changing the internal monologue from a judging one to a growth-oriented one. The Mindset Lectures. Just learning about the growth mindset can cause a big shift in the way people think about themselves and their lives. So each year in my undergraduate course, I teach about these mindsets, not only because they are part of the topic of the course, but also because I know what pressure these students are under. Every year, students describe to me how these ideas have changed them in all areas of their lives. Here is Maggie, the aspiring writer. "I recognize that when it comes to artistic or creative endeavors, I had internalized a fixed mindset. I believed that people were inherently artistic or creative, and that you could not improve through effort. This directly affected my life because I have always wanted to be a writer, but have been afraid to pursue any writing classes or to share my creative writing with others. This is directly related to my mindset because any negative criticism would mean that I am not a writer inherently. I was too scared to expose myself to the possibility that I might not be a natural. Now, after listening to your lectures, I've decided to register for a creative writing class next term, and I feel that I have really come to understand what was preventing me from pursuing an interest that has long been my secret dream. I really feel this information has empowered me. Maggie's internal monologue used to say, "Don't do it. Don't take a writing class. Don't share your writing with others. It's not worth the risk. Your dream could be destroyed. Protect it." Now it says, "Go for it. Make it happen. Develop your skills. Pursue your dream." And here's Jason, the athlete. As a student athlete at Columbia, I had exclusively the fixed mindset. Winning was everything, and learning did not enter the picture. However, after listening to your lectures, I realized that this is not a good mindset. I've been working on learning while I compete, under the realization that if I can continually improve, even in matches, I will become a much better athlete. Jason's internal monologue used to be, "Win-win. You have to win. Prove yourself. Everything depends on it." Now it's, "Observe, learn, improve. Become a better athlete." And finally, here's Tony, the recovering genius. In high school, I was able to get top grades with minimal studying and sleeping. I came to believe that it would always be so because I was naturally gifted with a superior understanding and memory. However, after about a year of sleep deprivation, my understanding and memory began to not be so superior anymore. When my natural talents, which I had come to depend on almost entirely for my self-esteem, as opposed to my ability to focus, my determination, or my ability to work hard, came into question, I went through a personal crisis that lasted until a few weeks ago, when you discussed the different mindsets in class. Understanding that a lot of my problems were the result of my preoccupation with proving myself to be smart and avoiding failures has really helped me get out of the self-destructive pattern I was living in. Tony's internal monologue went from, "I'm naturally gifted, I don't need to study, I don't need to sleep, I'm superior," to, "Uh-oh, I'm losing it, I can't understand things, I can't remember things, what am I now?" to, "Don't worry so much about being smart, don't worry so much about avoiding failures, that becomes self-destructive, let's start to study and sleep and get on with life." Of course, these people will have setbacks and disappointments, and sticking to the growth mindset may not always be easy, but just knowing it gave them another way to be. Instead of being held captive by some intimidating fantasy about the great writer, the great athlete, or the great genius, the growth mindset gave them the courage to embrace their own goals and dreams, and more important, it gave them a way to work toward making them real. A mindset workshop. Adolescence, as we have seen, is a time when hordes of kids turn off to school. You can almost hear the stampede as they try to get as far from learning as possible. This is a time when adults are facing some of the biggest challenges of their young lives, and a time when they are heavily evaluating themselves, often with a fixed mindset. It is precisely the kids with the fixed mindset who panic and run for cover, showing plummeting motivation and grades. Over the past few years, we've developed a workshop for these students. It teaches them the growth mindset and how to apply it to their schoolwork. Here is part of what they're told. Many people think of the brain as a mystery. They don't know much about intelligence and how it works. When they do think about what intelligence is, many people believe that a person is born either smart, average, or dumb, and stays that way for life. But new research shows that the brain is more like a muscle. It changes and gets stronger when you use it. And scientists have been able to show just how the brain grows and gets stronger when you learn. We then describe how the brain forms new connections and grows when people practice and learn new things. When you learn new things, these tiny connections in the brain actually multiply and get stronger. The more that you challenge your mind to learn, the more your brain cells grow. Then things that you once found very hard or even impossible, like speaking a foreign language or doing algebra, seem to become easy. The result is a stronger, smarter brain. We go on to point out that nobody laughs at babies and says how dumb they are because they can't talk. They just haven't learned yet. We show students a picture of how the density of brain connections changes during the first years of life as babies pay attention, study their world, and learn how to do things. Over a series of sessions, through activities and discussions, students are taught study skills and shown how to apply the lessons of the growth mindset to their studying and their schoolwork. Students love learning about the brain, and the discussions are very lively. But even more rewarding are the comments students make about themselves. Let's revisit Jimmy, the hardcore turned-off student from Chapter 3. In our very first workshop, we were amazed to hear him say, with tears in his eyes, "You mean I don't have to be dumb?" You may think these students are turned off, but I saw that they never stop caring. Nobody gets used to feeling dumb. Our workshop told Jimmy, "You're in charge of your mind. You can help it grow by using it the right way." And as the workshop progressed, here is what Jimmy's teacher said about him. Jimmy, who never puts in any extra effort and often doesn't turn in homework on time, actually stayed up late working for hours to finish an assignment early so I could review it and gave him a chance to revise it. He earned a B+ on the assignment. He had been getting C's and lower. Incidentally, teachers weren't just trying to be nice by telling us what we wanted to hear. The teachers didn't know who was in our growth mindset workshop. This was because we had another workshop, too. This workshop met just as many times and taught them even more study skills, and students got just as much personal attention from supportive tutors. But they didn't learn the growth mindset and how to apply it. Teachers didn't know which of their students went to which of the workshops, but they still singled out Jimmy and many of the students in the growth mindset workshop to tell us that they'd seen real changes in their motivation to learn and improve. Lately, I've noticed that some students have a greater appreciation for improvement. R was performing below standards. He has learned to appreciate the improvement of his grades from 52, 46, and 49 to his grades of 67 and 71. He valued his growth in learning mathematics. M was far below grade level. During the past several weeks, she has voluntarily asked for extra help from me during her lunch period in order to improve her test-taking performance. Her grades drastically improved from failing to an 84 on the most recent exam. Positive changes in motivation and behavior are noticeable in K and J. They have begun to work hard on a consistent basis. Several students have voluntarily participated in peer tutoring sessions during their lunch periods or after school. Students such as N and S were passing when they requested the extra help and were motivated by the prospect of sheer improvement. We were eager to see whether the workshop affected students' grades, so, with their permission, we looked at students' final marks at the end of the semester. We looked especially at their math grades, since those reflected real learning of challenging new concepts. Before the workshop, students' math grades had been suffering badly. But after, lo and behold, students who'd been in the growth mindset workshop showed a jump in their grades. They were now clearly doing better than the students who'd been in the other workshop. The growth mindset workshop, just 8 sessions long, had a real impact. This one adjustment of students' beliefs seemed to unleash their brain power and inspire them to work and achieve. Of course, they were in a school where the teachers were responsive to their outpouring of motivation and were willing to put in the extra work to help them learn. Even so, these findings show the power of changing mindsets. The students in the other workshop did not improve. Despite their 8 sessions of training and study skills and other good things, they showed no gains. Because they were not taught to think differently about their minds, they were not motivated to put the skills into practice. The mindset workshop put students in charge of their brains. Freed from the vice of the fixed mindset, Jimmy and others like him could now use their minds more freely and fully. Brainology. The problem with the workshop was that it required a big staff to deliver it. This wouldn't be feasible on a large scale. Plus, the teachers weren't directly involved. They could be helpful in helping to sustain the students' gains. So we decided to put our workshop on the interactive computer modules and have teachers guide their classes through the modules. With the advice of educational experts, media experts, and brain experts, we developed the Brainology program. It presents animated figures, Chris and Dahlia, 7th graders who are cool but are having problems with their schoolwork. Dahlia is having trouble with Spanish, and Chris with math. They visit the lab of Dr. Cerebrus, a slightly mad brain scientist, who teaches them all about the brain and the care and feeding of it. He teaches them what to do for maximum performance from the brain, like sleeping enough, eating the right things, and using good study strategies. And he teaches them how the brain grows as they learn. The program, all along, shows students how Chris and Dahlia apply these lessons to their schoolwork. The interactive portions allow students to do brain experiments, see videos of real students with their problems and study strategies, recommend study plans for Chris and Dahlia, and keep a journal of their own problems and study plans. Here are some of the seventh graders writing about how this program changed them. After Brainology, I now have a new look at things. Now my attitude toward the subjects I have trouble in is I try harder to study and master the skills. I've been using my time more wisely, studying every day and reviewing the notes that I took on that day. I'm really glad that I joined this program because it increased my intelligence about the brain. I did change my mind about how the brain works, and I do things differently. I will try harder because I know that the more you try, the more your brain works. All I can say is that Brainology changed my grades. Bon voyage! The Brainology program kind of made me change the way I work and study and practice for schoolwork now, that I know how my brain works and what happens when I learn. Thank you for making us study more and helping us build up our brain. I actually picture my neurons growing bigger as they make more connections. Teacher told us how formerly turned-off students were now talking the Brainology talk. For example, they were taught that when they studied well and learned something, they transferred it from temporary storage, working memory, to the more permanent storage, long-term memory. Now they were saying to each other, "I'll have to put that into my long-term memory. Sorry, that stuff is not in my long-term memory. I guess I was only using my working memory." Teachers said that students were also offered to practice, study, take notes, or pay attention more to make sure that neural connections would be made. As one student said, "Yes, the Brainology program helped a lot. Every time I thought about not doing work, I remembered that my neurons could grow if I did do the work." The teachers also changed. Not only did they say great things about how their students benefited, they also said great things about the insights they themselves had gained. In particular, they said Brainology was essential for understanding that all students can learn, even the ones who struggle with math and with self-control, that I have to be more patient because learning takes a great deal of time and practice. How the brain works, each learner learns differently. Brainology assisted me in teaching for various learning styles. Our workshop went to children in 20 schools. Some children admitted to being skeptical at first. I used to think it was just free time and a good cartoon, but I started listening to it and started doing what they told me to do. In the end, just about every child reported meaningful benefits. More about change. Is change easy or hard? So far, it sounds easy. Simply learning about the growth mindset seems to mobilize people for meeting challenges and persevering. The other day, one of my former grad students told me a story. But first, some background. In my field, when you submit a research paper for publication, that paper often represents years of work. Some months later, you receive your reviews, 10 or so pages of criticism, single-spaced. If the editor still thinks the paper has potential, you will be invited to revise it and resubmit it, provided you can address every criticism. My student reminded me of the time she had sent her thesis research to the top journal in our field. When the reviews came back, she was devastated. She had been judged, the work was flawed, and by extension, so was she. Time passed, but she couldn't bring herself to go near the reviews again or work on the paper. Then I told her to change her mindset. "Look," I said, "it's not about you. That's their job. Their job is to find every possible flaw. Your job is to learn from the critique and make your paper even better." Within hours, she was revising her paper, which was warmly accepted. She tells me, "I never felt judged again. Never. Every time I get that critique, I tell myself, 'Oh, that's their job,' and I get to work immediately on my job." But change is also hard. When people hold on to a fixed mindset, it's often for a reason. At some point in their lives, it served a good purpose for them. It told them who they were or who they wanted to be, a smart, talented child, and it told them how to be that, perform well. In this way, it provided a formula for self-esteem and a path to love and respect from others. The idea that they are worthy and will be loved is crucial for children, and if a child is unsure about being valued or loved, The fixed mindset appears to offer a simple, straightforward route to this. Psychologists Karen Horney and Carl Rogers, working in the mid-1900s, both proposed theories of children's emotional development. They believed that when young children feel insecure about being accepted by their parents, they experience great anxiety. They feel lost and alone in a complicated world. Since they're only a few years old, they can't simply reject their parents and say, "I think I'll go it alone." They have to find a way to feel safe and to win their parents over. Both Horney and Rogers propose that children do this by creating or imagining other selves, ones that their parents might like better. These new selves are what they think the parents are looking for, and what may win them the parents' acceptance. Often these steps are good adjustments to the family situation at the time, bringing the child some security and hope. The problem is that this new self, this all-competent, strong, good self that they now try to be, is likely to be a fixed-mindset self. Over time, the fixed traits may come to be the person's sense of who they are, and validating these traits may come to be the main source of their self-esteem. Mindset change asks people to give this up. As you can imagine, it's not easy to just let go of something that has felt like yourself for many years and that has given you your route to self-esteem. And it's especially not easy to replace it with a mindset that tells you to embrace all the things that have felt threatening, challenge, struggle, criticism, setbacks. When I was exchanging my fixed mindset for a growth one, I was acutely aware of how unsettled I felt. For example, I've told you how, as a fixed mindsetter, I kept track each day of all my successes. At the end of a good day, I could look at my results, the higher numbers on my intelligence counter, my personality counter, and so on, and feel good about myself. But as I adopted the growth mindset and stopped keeping track, some nights I would still check my mental counters and find them at zero. It made me insecure not being able to tote up my victories. Even worse, since I was taking more risks, I might look back over the day and see all the mistakes and setbacks and feel miserable. What's more, it's not as though the fixed mindset wants to leave gracefully. If the fixed mindset has been controlling your internal monologue, it can say some pretty strong things to you when it sees those counters at zero. You're nothing. It can make you want to rush right out and rack up some high numbers. The fixed mindset once offered you refuge from that very feeling, and it offers it to you again. Don't take it. Then there's the concern that you won't be yourself anymore. It may feel as though the fixed mindset gave you your ambition, your edge, your individuality. Maybe you fear you'll become a bland cog in the wheel just like everyone else. Ordinary. But opening yourself up to growth makes you more yourself, not less. The growth-oriented scientists, artists, athletes, and CEOs we've looked at were far from humanoids going through the motions. They were people in the full flower of their individuality and potency. Taking the first step, a workshop for you. The rest of the book is pretty much about you. It's a mindset workshop in which I ask you to venture with me into a series of dilemmas. In each case, you'll first see the fixed mindset reactions and then work through to a growth mindset solution. The first dilemma. Imagine you've applied to graduate school. You applied to just one place because it was the school you had your heart set on. And you were confident you'd be accepted since many people considered your work in the field to be original and exciting. But you were rejected. The fixed mindset reaction. At first you tell yourself that it was extremely competitive, so it doesn't really reflect on you. They probably had more first-rate applicants than they could accept. Then the voice in your head starts in. It tells you that you're fooling yourself, rationalizing. It tells you that the admissions committee found your work mediocre. After a while, you tell yourself it's probably true. The work is probably ordinary, pedestrian, and they'd seen that. They were experts. The verdict is in, and you're not worthy. With some effort, you talk yourself back into your first reasonable and more flattering conclusion, and you feel better. In the fixed mindset, and in most cognitive therapies, that's the end of it. You've regained your self-esteem, so the job is finished. But in the growth mindset, that's just the first step. All you've done is talk to yourself. Now comes the learning and self-improvement part. The growth mindset step. Think about your goal and think about what you could do to stay on track toward achieving it. What steps could you do to help yourself succeed? What information could you gather? Well, maybe you could apply to more schools next time, or maybe in the meantime you could gather more information about what makes a good application. What are they looking for? What experiences do they value? You could seek out those experiences before the next application. Since this is a true story, I know what step the rejected applicant took. She was given some growth mindset advice, and a few days later she called the school. When she located the relevant person and told him the situation, she said, "I don't want to dispute your decision. I just want to know, if I decide to apply again in the future, how I can improve my application. I would be very grateful if you could give me some feedback along those lines." Nobody scoffs at an honest plea for helpful feedback. Several days later, he called her back and offered her admission. It had indeed been a close call, and after reconsidering her application, the department decided they could take one more person that year. Plus, they liked her initiative. She had reached out for information that would allow her to learn from experience and improve in the future. It turned out in this case that she didn't have to improve her application. She got to plunge right into learning in her new graduate program. Plans that you'll carry out and ones that you won't. The key part of our applicant's reaction was her call to the school to get more information. It wasn't easy. Every day people plan to do difficult things, but they don't do them. They think, "I'll do it tomorrow," and they swear to themselves that they'll follow through the next day. Research by Peter Gulwitzer and his colleagues shows that vowing, even intense vowing, is often useless. The next day comes, and the next day goes. What works is making a vivid, concrete plan. Tomorrow, during my break, I'll get a cup of tea, close the door to my office, and call the graduate school. Or, in another case, on Wednesday morning, right after I get up and brush my teeth, I'll sit at my desk and start writing my report. Or, tonight, right after the dinner dishes are done, I'll sit down with my wife in the living room and have that discussion. I'll say to her, "Dear, I'd like to talk about something that I think will make us happier." Think of something you need to do, something you want to learn, or a problem you have to confront. What is it? Now make a concrete plan. When will you follow through on your plan? Where will you do it? How will you do it? Think about it in vivid detail. These concrete plans, plans you can visualize about when, where, and how you are going to do something, lead to really high levels of follow-through, which of course ups the chances of success. So the idea is not only to make a growth mindset plan, but also to visualize in a concrete way how you are going to carry it out. Feeling bad, but doing good. Let's go back a few paragraphs to when you were rejected by the graduate school. Suppose your attempt to make yourself feel better had failed. You could still have taken the growth mindset. You can feel miserable and still reach out for information that will help you improve. Sometimes after I have a setback, I go through the process of talking to myself about what it means and how I plan to deal with it. Everything seems fine, until I sleep on it. In my sleep, I have dream after dream of loss, failure, or rejection, depending on what happened. Once, when I'd experienced a loss, I went to sleep and had the following dreams. My hair fell out, my teeth fell out, I had a baby and it died, and so on. Another time, when I felt rejected, my dreams generated countless rejection experiences, real and imagined. In each instance, the incident triggered a theme, and my too active imagination gathered up all the variations on the theme to place before me. When I woke up, I felt as though I had been through the wars. It would be nice if this didn't happen, but it's irrelevant. It might be easier to mobilize for action if I felt better, but it doesn't matter. The plan is the plan. Remember the depressed students with the growth mindset? The worse they felt, the more they did the constructive thing. The less they felt like it, the more they made themselves do it. The critical thing is to make a concrete, growth-oriented plan and to stick to it. The number one draft choice. The last dilemma seemed hard, but basically, it was solved by a phone call. Now imagine you're a promising quarterback. In fact, you're the winner of the Heisman Trophy, college football's highest award. You're the top draft pick of the Philadelphia Eagles, the team you've always dreamed of playing for. So what's the dilemma? The second dilemma, the pressure is overwhelming. You yearn for playing in the games, but every time they put you in a game to try you out, you turn anxious and lose your focus.